The Stuff of Dreams, 1953-54. As Betsy sped towards the coast, Cress parried the whys and hows with a version of events that made Ulysses and the kid laugh, or gasp. The truth, though, was quieter than entertainment, carried more sentiment, as the old boy might have said himself. And this version had begun 3 months before, when old Cress had been sitting with Ulysses on a bench overlooking the canal. The sun had been low, firing the water with sharp flames of pink and gold. Ulysses had just expressed his fear about leaving London, and Cress had said, "It's about Peggy the kid, ain't it?" And Ulysses had said, "And you." "And you." Those two words had confused Cress, because not much love had ever come his way. The deep satisfaction of hearing those words, mixed with the sorrow of never having heard them before, made for an uncomfortable alliance, and prompted him to say, "Nothing's forever." A trite and clichéd response to a young man's declaration of care.
"So what's this place, Florence, like?" it said.
"Like that," said Ulysses, and he'd pointed to the colours illuminated in the canal, the shimmering peace, the iridescent light. And Ulysses had said, "What would my dad do, Cress?" And Cress had said,
"That's easy, son, everything on the black."
And he'd flicked his cigarette away, and then Ulysses said it. "Come with me, Cress."
"I'm too old," said Cress.
"Too much love for one day. I'm too old." End of. The nights that had followed this conversation had brought Cress little sleep. Too many what-ifs resided on the pillow, and they were niggly and hard and pushed the old boy out in search of answers.
"Too old," said the cherry tree. "That's a bit ripe. One of my ancestors is more than 1,000 years old, and they're still up for stuff. Your idea of time is obtuse."
"You reckon?" said Cress.
"Just saying."
A breeze slipped through the branches and made the Prunus serrilata shudder.
"I'd love it when it does that," said Tree. "And another thing, I always thought you wanted a passport. You've been going on about it for years."
And it was true, Cressy had. So Cress filled in the application, and a couple of months later, early May it was, he received a passport in the post, a distinct creak in the spine when he opened it. But still the decision grumbled. Tree said,
"You've got the time, and you've still got the money."
Cress nodded. It was true, he did.
"And for years you've felt like a change."
"I have."
"It's that Peg, isn't it?"
said Tree eventually, and Cress's shoulders slumped.
"Yeah," he said. "It's her."
Cress met her by the canal a couple of days later. Clack, 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 down the stairs she came. "You decided yet?" she said, and he shook his head. "You want me to decide for you?" she said, and he nodded. "Go," she said. "You always wanted to see the world. Go look after him for me. Keep him safe." And Cress held her hand and said,
"I'm getting on. I couldn't bear to think I'd ever see you again."
"It's Italy, Cress, not the bleeding moon." And she got up, kissed his head, and didn't look back. Next day, Cress went to Thomas Cook in the West End and bought his ticket. He'd written the time of Ulysses' ferry on a slip of paper and pushed it across the counter to the young woman.
"Dover Calais," he said. "One way," he said.
"One way?" smiled the young woman. Cress nodded. There was something regal in the way life was unfolding.
"So when you off?" said the tree.
"Day after tomorrow," said Cress.
"Ooh, blimey, soon."
Cress nodded and supped his stout.
"You got a lot to do?"
"One or two things,"
Tree said. "Thanks for everything. It's been nice knowing you."
"You too," said Cress. "Will you be okay?"
"I'm a tree. I've done this 1,000 times before."
"Done what?"
"Goodbyes."
"Really?"
"Think about it. Leaves."
Dover came into sight just before lunch, and the Jowett Bradford entered the eastern docks where the air smelt of diesel and salt. Beyond the cranes and jetties, the open sea beckoned, and there was a fair chop to the water. The day was cold. The day was doing its best impression of November. They parked up in the customs shed and stretched their legs. Ulysses told Cress to leave the small suitcase with the rest of the luggage, but Cress insisted he keep it with him. And maybe it was Cress's unusual attire or the one-way ticket out of England they all held, but the cursory searches of other vehicles became a full-blown search of theirs. Kid found it exciting and shadowed the humourless customs officer, much to his annoyance.
"Have you looked in here?" she said. "What about here? Maybe there's stuff hidden in the tyres."
A final look into Cress's large suitcase revealed nothing but a small selection of clothes. Two open-neck shirts, underwear and vests, a flannel suit, a shaving kit, toothbrush and paste, knitting needles and wool, liniment, old boots and three books. The 1899 Baedeker Italy Handbook for Travellers, Bradshaw's Complete Anglo-Italian Phrasebook, and a novel, a rare choice for Factsman Cress, E.M. Forster's A Room with a View, first edition but with the back cover missing. "Cress?" said Ulysses. Cress was still talking to the officer about his last-minute dash for the car. "Cress," said Ulysses again. "It's done. You can put your stuff away. The bloke's not interested." Cress closed the lid of his large suitcase and secured the catches. The false bottom containing several hundred pounds of the Fanny Wynne had remained concealed. And more importantly, the small suitcase in his hand had gone unchecked. "What are you looking so pleased about?" said Ulysses. Cress shrugged and walked zen-like towards the car. The kid clambered in the back, and Cress sat down with the suitcase on his lap. The hours spent reading about psychophysical magic had been worth it, he thought. To render the visible invisible had been one of his greatest achievements. Ulysses got in and started the ignition. "Calais, here we come," he said. Then he threw his hat in the back and looked across at Cress. He couldn't be sure, but it seemed Cress was cradling the suitcase like it was a baby. On deck, the horn blared and the wind whipped up something rotten. They waved goodbye to the white cliffs. "Goodbye, England. Goodbye forever." Ulysses thought about Peg, and Cress thought about Peg, and the kid thought about lunch. They went down into the warm and ate ham sandwiches and crisps as the grey water rolled hard against the side of the ship. Kid was glued to the sight of a man vomiting in the corner, and Cress held on to his cup of English tea as if it was to be his last. They drove onto French soil at 4 in the afternoon, and the sky was dark and low and making rain. Unfamiliar signs rushed past and cars drove on the wrong side of the road. When Betsy was clear of the terminal, Cress asked Ulysses to stop as soon as he could, and thinking Cress had been caught short, Ulysses pulled over sharpish onto a grass verge. But Cress didn't move. Cars passed by and a whip of rain hit the windscreen. "You okay, Cress?" But Cress remained silent and focused like a monk. Cress flexed his fingers and breathed loudly through his mouth. He flicked the catches on the small suitcase and opened the lid. On top was an orange Shetland sweater, which he carefully lifted out. Underneath, either asleep or dead, was a large blue Amazonian parrot.
"Claude," said Kid.
"Geez, Cress, how?"
"Shh," said Cress. "We're not clear of death's door yet."
And Cress felt for a pulse.
"Nothing,"
he said gravely. He lifted the parrot to his ear.
"It's faint, but he's breathing."
And he began to massage the bird's chest.
"You see a pipette of water in the case, Temps?"
"I do. Here you go," said Ulysses, and Cress slipped the pipette into Claude's beak.
"He's drinking," he said. "That's a good sign."
"But how the hell did you..."
"I read a veterinary book about dosages," said Cress, "mostly about the transportation of chickens. But I figured, pound for pound, I was probably dealing with a similar genetic structure. I took a chance, Temps. Couldn't leave him alone with Cole, could I? That bird would never have survived another molt. If I was coming, so was he. That's the reason I was so late. He wouldn't go under."
"Can I hold him, Cressy?" said the kid.
"Course you can."
And Cress wrapped the bird in his sweater and handed the bundle over the back seat.
"Gently now," he said. "Keep him upright and give him the water. That's it. And a gentle rub on his chest now and then. There we go.
Claude opened his eyes and blinked, bewildered. The slow dawning he was about 120 miles from the pub without having taken flight, and that, for a parrot, was a lot to take in.
"Are we nearly there yet?"
he said, and the three of them laughed, and Ulysses winked at him in the rearview mirror. Claude felt loved up, with a sudden propensity to rub. He had a flashback to the fermented seeds he and his mates used to imbibe in the Amazon.
"Good times,"
he thought. He fell back to sleep, imagining he was covered in a light pink fuzz. They drove for 3 hours down through the plains of Picardy. Nearing Laon, Ulysses told Cress and the kid to keep an eye out for the village of Soutigny, a place Pete had promised wouldn't disappoint. But by the time they reached the outskirts of that nondescript French village, the rain hadn't eased and the deserted streets were awash, and it was hard to imagine the place doing anything other than disappoint. Ulysses pulled over and peered through the windscreen as the wiper whipped back and forth.
"What did Pete say verbatim?" said Chris.
"That he'd spent many a happy night in a gem of a hideaway on the main square." Chris closed his eyes and channeled.
"Main square, main square, main square."
"Straight on,"
he said, opening his eyes.
"Sure?"
"Positive,"
he said. And as the 8 o'clock bells chimed, the Jowett Bradford rolled into the main, and only, it had to be said, square, and stopped in front of a bistro with rows of white lights and a red neon sign flashing Chambre. "We found the gem," said Ulysses. At the front desk, Claude pecked on the bell, and out from the dusty curtain, an older landlady appeared, as if she was the glamorous denouement of a magic act.
"Bienvenue, welcome," she purred.
No willkommen, as it was still too soon for Germans to be welcomed in the village. She said she had one room left and would organize a camp bed for the kid and newspaper for the parrot. She flicked a switch behind the desk and the red chambre sign went out. "Full," she said proudly. She led them into the dining room, hazy with smoke and chat from salesmen. The photographs that adorned the walls were of her many lovers and husbands, she explained. At least that's what they thought, she said, as their ears tried to sift through the broken fragments of her English.
"Beef bourguignon and chips," she said.
"Yes, please,"
they nodded. She seated them at a table overlooked by moribund Dennis, a local boule champion with a huge moustache and an impressive trophy. She brought out a carafe of red wine and sunflower seeds for the perroquet and made eyes at Cressy in a way that made him wish his shorts were longer. When she left, Cress poured out the wine, and Kid held out her glass and said,
"Fill it up now, Cress."
Cress said,
"You're too young. Give it time."
And Kid said,
"Is this how it's going to be?"
"How's what going to be?"
"Because I could have got this at home."
And Kid sat back and scowled. "And there's Peg," thought Ulysses. Half an hour later, Kid was asleep across a plate of frites. They were the last to leave the dining room. The landlady brought out brandy on the house, and Ulysses told Cress that him being with them had made them whole. Cress didn't know what to do with such a declaration, all that love again. Ulysses paid the bill and lifted the kid without waking her. On the way out, he suddenly stopped at the photograph nearest the door.
"Here, Cress, look at this," he said.
Cress squinted.
"Blimey, is that who I think?"
"Yeah," smiled Ulysses.
"Well, I never."
It was Pete at a piano, caught in a clinch with the landlady. He was wearing a large beret and little else.
"I've never seen him in a hat before,"
said Cress. "Me neither," said Ulysses. "It'd look even better on his head." The kid was put to bed, and Ulysses felt an added preciousness that night, a greater need to watch over her. Cress came back from the bathroom with the front of his pyjamas soaked.
"The hot tap's cold, the cold's hot, and there's a lot of pressure in the pipes. Thought I'd better warn you," he whispered.
"Thanks, Cress."
"Gave me a bit of a shock."
"Well, if you're not expecting it."
"All this newness
expands the mind." Cress took the left-hand side of the bed and settled down.
"When I was a kid," he said, "I used to lie like this and think there was a world out there. And now I'm in it, Temps."
"Feels good, right?"
"Feels like nothing else. Early start tomorrow, Cress.
Don't worry, I'll be there.
8 days it would take. 8 days to cross 3 countries and countless landscapes. A map was consulted occasionally, but there was mostly a feeling of holidaying in the air, of spontaneity. And that was because of Cress. Cress joining them had changed everything. He looked out of the window, a quiet understanding that his life would have been less had he died without witnessing another corner of the planet. Kid only looked up from her sketchbook when the smell of farmland with its mucky, fetid lilt filled the car. They slept in sleeping bags under stars, downwind from smouldering campfires to keep mosquitoes away. Mornings came early with the rise of sun and a chill river to wash in. A crawl into the nearest village brought bread and jam and coffee, and the kid got a taste for the stuff and took it milky. They chose hot meals at lunchtime, but at night it was bread and cheese and wine, and lots of stone fruit because fruit was sweet and plentiful. Cress got the shits, and the following day they travelled slow. Lost a bit of time while Cress dug holes across the mountainous Jura, dark forests and fast-running silver streams and pockets of pervasive silence. Worst places to wipe an arse. That was the day they found out about Davy. Kid was sticking a postcard in her sketchbook, places she'd been, her mum's idea. She turned the pages and a drawing caught Ulysses' eye and he said, "That's Ginny, right?" Kid nodded. In the picture, Ginny was holding hands with a boy wearing glasses. Same smile, same height. Boy had shaded skin. "And that's you," said Ulysses, pointing to the smaller figure.
"Yep, and that's Ginny's."
Kid suddenly stopped. "I know she has a boyfriend," said Ulysses. "Cress does too."
"What's that?"
said Cress, walking back into the conversation. "Ginny's boyfriend," said Ulysses.
"Oh yeah, Davy,"
said Cress. Kid rolled her eyes.
"Devy,"
she said.
"Devy,"
said Cress and Ulysses in unison.
"Devian. He's the same as Ginny. He's big, but a kid. He lives somewhere else. Mrs. Core's his auntie."
"Mrs. Core is," said Ulysses. And there the last piece of the puzzle fell into place.
"What's the matter?"
said Kid. "Could I have this picture?" said Ulysses.
"Why?"
said the kid. "I want to send it to Peg."
"You think she'd like it?"
"I know she would. We'll put it in an envelope with a postcard, show her how far we've come." They all wrote on the postcard. All wrote, "Wish you were here." And Ulysses wrote a little extra note with a bit of context to go with the picture. In Switzerland, Ulysses posted the envelope back to Peg, and Kid got her first pair of sunglasses as thanks. They were too big for her, but what did she care? Cress said he'd secure them with string, and Kid said,
"Better be nice string."
And they strolled the promenade and watched steamers cross back and forth across the lake. And the air smelt sharp and expensive. Mountain tops cast down piercing light, and tourists in fashionable attire stopped to take their photograph. Click. 2 men, one in shorts, a girl and a parrot. Now that's a story to tell. On the 9th day, they crossed from Emilia-Romagna into Tuscany. Olive trees carried white flowers, swallows and swifts took ownership of the sky. The grass smelt scorched and poppies were abundant. An occasional whiff of rosemary or lavender seeded by the roadside was a heady accompaniment. To Ulysses, every smell was a ghost. They drove south out of a dark haze of cypress trees, and Florence suddenly appeared in the Arno Valley, resplendent under golden June light. Ulysses stopped the car and got out. He raised his hat and saluted the city as Darnley had done before. Claude took flight, and the blue of his feathers against the terracotta rooftops was an electrifying sight. They'd travelled more than 1,000 miles, had eaten 20 plates of spaghetti, 9 stews, 17 baguettes, a crop of apricots and a wheel of cheese. They had drunk 40 coffees and 8 bottles of wine and 7 beers and 2 brandies. Nights in a bed, one, the first. They had seen wild boar and falcons and stars falling across the Alps. And they'd come to rely on one another, because they were all they had. The notary, or notaio, they had arranged to meet, was situated in the north of the city, a couple of streets behind the Piazza della Santissima Annunziata, according to the map in Cress's Baedeker. Ulysses parked in the splendid square
underneath a large equestrian statue that Cressy said was of Ferdinand I.
"Who's Ferdinand I?" said Kid.
And Cress said he was a man who had a lot of fingers in a lot of pies. They left Claude to guard the car. The narrow streets were teeming with bikes and pedestrians, and out of nowhere trolleys would clatter past, piled high with crates of wine or vegetables. The air was a heady mix of garlic and coffee and drains. There was so much to see, to smell, to hear. "This way," shouted Cress, marching ahead with his map. And by 5 o'clock, they were outside the offices of Il Signor Massimo Buontalenti. Kid pressed the bell on the brass plaque, and the door to the modest 18th-century building opened immediately. The office was on the second floor, and Signor Buontalenti was waiting for them at the top of the stairs with a tray of coffee. They liked him immediately. He was a small, stylish man, 40 perhaps, with an affable smile and a wild sprouting of dark hair that gave the impression he'd just been electrocuted. His English, though, was terrific. "Signor Tempa," he said, "at last! I've been expecting you. For 2 days now, I've been waiting." "We got held up in the Alps, signore," a sentence Ulysses never in a million years expected to say. It was a straightforward transaction. Took no time for the paperwork to be signed and the deeds to the property transferred. Signor Massimo said he would go with Ulysses in the coming days to set up a bank account in which the remainder of the money could be deposited. He replaced the cap on his fountain pen, a distinct and expensive click, and returned it to his jacket pocket. He smiled and said, "Allora." And Cress, thinking now was as good a time as any to make a start on the lingo, said, "Allora," too. "So, what else do you need to know, Signor Tempa?" And Ulysses said, "I made a list, signore," and he handed it to Massimo. Massimo scanned the paper. "Lavanderia, laundry, yes, yes. I suggest Manfredi," mumble, mumble. "Schools?"
"Who said anything about school?" whispered the kid.
"Shh, we'll talk about it later," said Ulysses.
"I didn't come here for school," she said. "I could have got that at home."
"You like ice cream, signorina?"
"Who doesn't?" said the kid.
"Ice cream's a way of life here." "Keep talking," she said. "Two places for you, Perché No and Vivoli." Kid turned to Ulysses.
"You got that?"
"Got it," said Ulysses. Massimo continued. "The cemetery where Arturo is buried. I think it's up at San Miniato al Monte." He looked through some paperwork. "Yes, yes, it is. In the family vault in the Cimitero delle Porte Sante." "And what else?" "Ah, telephone, easy. You need tokens. Gettoni. For the public telephones, and from the post office you can call England." "You want to call England now?"
"Could we?"
"Your wish is my command." And when the coffee was finished, he took them down to an office where a young woman dialed the number and made the connection. "Un momento," she said, before handing the receiver to Ulysses. It was Col who picked up.
"Un bloody momento.
Col, it's me.
I know it's you, and thank God for that. Cressy's missing. I told the cops to dredge the canal. Poor old fucker.
Cressy's with me."
"What? What'd you do? Kidnap him?"
"No, I didn't kidnap him." Cress leant into the receiver and said,
"I came voluntarily, Col. I'm having a lovely time."
"Traitors, both of you. You got that bloody parrot too." Pause. "What makes you think I've got the parrot?" said Ulysses.
"I don't. That was a joke. Pete reckons Tubby ate it."
"Why would anyone eat a parrot?"
"To show me what he's capable of."
"And what's that, a varied diet?"
"Probably tastes like chicken," said Cress.
"What's he saying?" said Cole. "Cress said the parrot probably tastes like chicken."
"God help me," said Cole. "Guinea pigs taste like duck," said Cress. "What's he saying now?"
said Cole. "Something about guinea pigs."
"Jesus Christ, just when I started to miss the old boy. Tubby should have eaten him first. Anyway, Temps, what you want? I know you didn't phone me to tell me the weather.
Hot and sunny.
Fuck off.
Tell Peg we're here."
"Let me just write that down. Tell Peg Temps.
Yeah, funny. And look out for her for me. Don't I always?" "Ginny okay?" Ulysses could hear a peppermint being unwrapped.
"She's fine," said Carl. "She's over at Mrs. Cor's. Don't know what it is about that woman, but she makes her happy.
Cole, I've got to go. Take care of yourself, right?
And don't forget Pig. I never forget Pig. Ulysses replaced the receiver. Massimo held up a set of keys and said, "Shall we?" And he ushered them out of the door. "You can tell me about the parrot and the guinea pig in the car," he added. Despite Massimo's outward appearance, he was at heart an unconventional man, always had been. And to be sitting in the front passenger seat of an English car named Betsy with a parrot on his shoulder was as good as life got. He issued clear instruction to get them to the south of the city. "Left here, mind the tram, Signor Temper. Right here, the tram, Signor Temper." And he nodded and smiled at pedestrians who stared at him, as if to confirm their eyes were not deceiving them. And yes, it was he, Signor Massimo Buontalenti, popular notary and all-round legal expert, revealing his closeted bohemian side. They crossed the Arno on the cusp of evening. The water flared with colour, and buildings surrendered their reflections to the untroubled surface. A solitary rower passed under the bridge, and the scene drew a gasp from Cressy.
"Look," he said. "Look there," he said. "Such wonder."
A maze of narrow streets brought the Jowett Bradford to a stop alongside a church at the northeastern corner of a tree-lined piazza. The last of the contadini, the farmers, had gone, and all that remained of the daily market was straw and donkey scat and damaged fruit that sent the flies crazy. Over the far side, people were gathered outside a cafe as they had been 9 years before. Ulysses opened the door and climbed out. He leant on the bonnet and took in the scene. He was careful with the memory. A bicycle traversed the stones, handlebars piled high with gilded picture frames. "It's that building over there," said Massimo, pointing to the cream and brown building that dominated the south side of the square.
"All set, boy," said Cressy.
"All set."
"Then what are we waiting for?" said Kid, putting on her sunglasses. "Come on," she said,
and lifted out the globe and her suitcase. They managed as much luggage as they could between them and crossed the square unwittingly in ascending order of height. The old women on the stone benches looked up from their knitting and watched them pass. Boys by the fountain laughed and pointed to the parrot and said, "Papagallo." A group of men came out of the cafe, and Ulysses heard the words "soldato" and "arrivato."
"Through here," said Massimo,
holding open the large wooden door with his foot. The vestibule was cool and carried the lingering smell of stone and sewage, which Massimo said were the two patron saints of Florentine stench. Behind them, an elegant glass door led out to a cortile, crisscrossed with lines of drying washing. "And this is your postbox, Signor Tempa," and he indicated the one awaiting a name. "And now, we climb," he said. He led them up to a bright landing of black and white tiles and a comatose pot plant. He waited for them to gather before he placed his hand against the door and said,
"So this is it, your new home." "The start of our new life," said Cress.
There was a brief moment of acknowledgement, raised eyebrows mostly, before Massimo inserted the key and disappeared into the dark and airless hallway. They followed him in like the blind of the Great War, and as their eyes began to adjust, they could make out the scattering of white sheets that covered the furniture, the faint slither of daylight creeping through an occasional broken slat. Signor Massimo clapped his hands and flicked the switches, and the hallway and living room flooded with light. Cress dropped his luggage.
"Bloody hell, Temps, it's huge!"
Windows were opened, shutters thrown back, and sounds from the square rushed in. Ulysses looked about. So little had changed and the sequence of time reversed, and there he was, young and invincible again, in front of a typewriter that had offered up his name. Kid screamed and ran around with Claude looking for her bedroom, and Cress still commentating on the size and elegance of the place.
"Look at all them books and paintings, Temps."
Massimo smiling at their delight. Massimo, one of life's givers, soon to become a friend. An upright piano too, used as a side table, judging by the ornaments and candelabra strewn across its top. "Signor Temper," said Massimo, nudging Ulysses out of his stupor. "Shall we?" And together they lifted dust sheets off two velvet sofas, the faded orange replaced since wartime by a taut, vivid blue.
Terracotta tiles ran beneath their feet, and above them frescoes, pale pinks and blues and acanthus leaves and birds in flight, and a starlit sky with constellations that really would look like night at the right hour in the right light. Four bedrooms and not three, as Ulysses had remembered, two overlooking the square at the front, two the cortile behind. A bathroom which again defied Ulysses' memory by being much larger, or maybe had become much larger, in the years since he'd been there. And the kitchen.
A refrigerator! Shouted Cress. Who has a refrigerator?
We do,
said Kid, still on a runabout. Two ovens, one gas and an old unused coal one, and Cress's mind trying to take in the workings of a new system.
Fuse box here, said Signor Massimo. The boiler is in the cellar. All straightforward, really.
Massimo turned the stopcock, and the pipes and toilet cistern began to rumble. He left the room and Kid ran in and said she found a telescope.
Come see, Cressy.
And Cressy went see. And then silence. Ulysses alone. He stood in the doorway to the kitchen and remembered holding open a book of paintings and delivering a faltering explanation about grief and a dance, things Evelyn and Darnley had so eloquently, so effortlessly explained. If you had asked him then if they'd all come through unscathed, he'd have bet his life on it. He would have pushed his body and soul across the green bays as the wheel spun. He crouched under the table and felt for the raised edge of a tile. Gritty deposits caught under his nails, and he tugged at the edge till it gave way. He reached into the gape of the cubbyhole and wondered if, over time, it had become a home to mice or rats. Those thoughts fell away, though, as his hand landed on the smooth, cold edge of a wine bottle. He lifted it into the light. Adhered to its side was the image of Pontormo's deposition from the cross, ripped from its book. You knew I'd come, he thought. He went out onto the terrace, him and a wilting orange tree awaiting an old man's care. Swifts squealing overhead as cypress hills became misty and grew dark. The smells of cooking rising from the kitchens below, violet light falling onto the city, casting it into eternity. He climbed over the railing and walked down the roof. Down below, outside the cafe, a large man in an apron was watching him. It wasn't as steep as he recollected, and yet he stopped midway by one of the chimneys because he knew he wasn't invincible anymore.
You okay, Signor Tempa?
Massimo calling out from the terrace behind him. Ulysses nodded.
Then don't let one of the greatest adventures of my life end here. Please come back in, now.
They gathered in the hallway as the sun dipped west and the last of the shadows cut across the floor. Ulysses held out his hand and thanked Massimo for everything.
My pleasure, said Massimo. But we still have business to conclude before we say our goodbyes. We still have to go downstairs.
Downstairs?
Yes. The floor below, Signor Tempa. Didn't you know? That's yours too.
It was late, and Kid was asleep. And Cress and Ulysses sat at the kitchen table in the silence Massimo's departure had left. The two men were worn out by wealth.
If this is what rich people feel, said Cress, no wonder they're miserable.
The apartment below had been of a similar layout, but with simpler decor than the top floor. It had been rented out up until a year ago, and Massimo had said he would help Ulysses should he decide to do the same, or to sell it. I don't know what I need to do, Ulysses had said, and Massimo had laughed and slapped him on the shoulder. Call me, he said, the sound of his footsteps departing on the stairs. Ulysses lit a cigarette and handed it to Cress.
We are such stuff as dreams are made on, said Claude.
They turned towards the parrot.
Where does he get it from? Said Ulysses.
Cress shrugged.
Search me.
They smoked. They listened to the run of water through the pipes, the susurration of the refrigerator. Ulysses went to check on the kid, and when he came back, he said, What are we going to do, Cress?
Now? Or in a month? Or
now? Cress thought for a moment.
Observe and learn, I reckon. But first, you open the wine, and I'll get the cheese and sausage I kept back for emergency.
Ulysses got up and looked for a bottle opener.
Cress said, we're embarking on a world of new language and new systems. A world of stares and misunderstandings and humiliations. And we'll feel every single one of them, boy. But we mustn't let our inability to know what's what diminish us, because it'll try. We have to remain curious and open. Two words for you. Ley lines.
Ley lines?
Straight lines of electromagnetic energy crisscrossing the earth at special sites, drawing men and women and ideas to their mysterious pulse. We were drawn here, Thames, no two ways about it, as many have been before. That Baedeker book, you know what it said?
Go on.
That even those whose usual avocations are of the most prosaic nature unconsciously become admirers of poetry and art in Italy. Would that be so bad? To become an admirer of poetry and art until we figure it all out?
It wouldn't, Chris.
To be infused with all the city has to offer and has offered over the centuries? Our purpose revealing itself like the slow unfolding of an iris flower?
Ulysses grinned. It started already, Cress.
What has?
The poetry. Cress blushed and stood up.
I'll get the cheese, he said.
The following morning, the square was abuzz. You've seen who's back, they all said as they entered Michele's cafe. Clara the baker had told the butcher, who had told the priest during confession. Gloria Cardinali, who sold haberdashery, was lighting a candle in the church and had overheard the butcher tell the priest. She couldn't wait to tell her neighbour, the tripe seller, who told Signor Malfatti, who sold cheese.
And of course Signor Malfatti couldn't wait to tell me, said the elderly Contessa,
who was having a very public spat with a man over the contested weight of a single ball of ricotta.
So,
she said, leaning over Michele's counter, drinking her first espresso of the day.
A kid and no wife.
And what do you want me to do about that? Said Michele.
Just saying, said the Contessa,
spooning out the last dregs of her coffee.
And a parrot, she added, and those shorts.
The parrot was wearing shorts, said Julia,
Michele's wife. The Contessa scowled at her. Signora Mimi came in, and before she could say anything, Julia said, We know, Signora, he's back.
He looks less boyish, no? Said Signora Mimi. A little more drawn here?
And she ran her hand down her cheeks.
But he still has his dimples, and is that his father with him?
His father has a certain... The priest rushed in. You've seen who's back?
Madonna mia, said Michele quietly,
knocking back his fourth espresso of the morning. The elderly Contessa was actually the first person the bleary-eyed English group met that morning. They were coming down the stairs as she was going up. Claude squawked, and she stopped, mouth agape at the sight of her new neighbours.
Buongiorno,
said Cress with a slight bow.
Is it?
Said the Contessa, hurrying to get inside her first-floor apartment.
She seems nice, said Cress.
And as the 9 o'clock bells chimed, they stepped out into the square, and as far as entrances went, it was pretty theatrical. Sunlight dazzled, casting rays onto the pale cream stucco of the church. The sky was blue, the roofs were red, the trees green. For years they'd moved about in a palette of grey and deprivation, and now this. The air was saturated with the sounds and smells of the market, and the steamy waft from the tripe cellar crept around the corner and punched them in the guts. Claude flew to the white marble statue of Cosimo Ridolfi and settled on his head. He would stay there and shit on him all morning. Eyes followed them as they traversed the stones, and Ulysses heard that word soldato again. Kid ran off towards a donkey, and Cress exclaimed at the abundance of produce.
The cornucopia of delight, were his exact words,
classic Cressy. Ulysses headed straight over to an outside table at Michele's and sat down. He lit a cigarette and wondered how he could make another man's life his own.
Over here,
he shouted when coffee was on its way.
Coming,
said Cress, who had just acquired a watermelon as big as his head. It was from that outside table at Michele's that they eased into Italian life. Popular with locals and visitors alike, a jukebox played morning and night, and photographs of cinema stars and Campari posters brought a touch of glamour to the nicotine-stained walls. Plates of food came and went under the scrutinizing gaze of Julia, a touch of glamour in her own right, and gradually names became recognizable, things like Farona,
Giddy Fowl,
said Cress, and Fiori di Zucca Fritti,
fried courgette flowers, said the kid.
They learnt that the ubiquitous back of a lorry appeared in the market after the carabinieri had left and shifted a whole lot of ecclesiastical reliquary and knocked off radio sets. No different to home then. And the basket lowered from an upstairs window was for shoes when the cobbler was shut. In the Uffizi, they learnt to tell the difference between a Botticelli and a Leonardo.
Which one? Said Cress.
Botticelli, said Ulysses.
Wrong,
said Kid. And they learnt that the old women gathered on the stone benches every day to knit and broker gossip. Kid soon clocked up 152 words of Italian and a smudge of slang, and began to scowl like a native. She tried coccoli for the first time, balls of deep-fried bread dough, and declared it was her second best day ever. The citrus aurantium, the ornamental orange tree wilting in the shade, was brought back to life by nothing more than a larger pot and a few kind words. On the night of the 24th, fireworks shot across the sky, and no one knew why.
Feast of San Giovanni,
said the tree to Cress. And one afternoon, Ulysses found a bike in the cellar and cycled from San Niccolo in the east to San Frediano in the west. He discovered workshops of every kind, antique furniture repairers, carvers, gilders, carpenters, but no one who made globes. He noticed Italian men wore shoes without socks and trousers that hung shy of an ankle. The women were beautiful, but not more beautiful than Peg. And always he was followed by stares.
The stares are not malicious, explained Massimo, a month after Ulysses had acquired his Italian bank account.
They were walking down the Via dei Calzaiuoli together, and for Massimo to have the parrot again on his shoulder added an element of flair to his daily conformity. He turned heads wherever he went. In truth, he'd never felt more alive since Ulysses had entered his life. He explained to Ulysses that he'd begun to spend time around Santo Spirito purely to eavesdrop and to assess the impact of Ulysses' arrival on the neighbourhood. He said the public bathhouse on Via Sant'Agostino had become a good source of information, and he touched his hair when he said this. They veered off the main thoroughfare and stopped at a small cafe with outside tables. The air was whiffy, and July's heat was multiplying the spores. They collected their espressi from the counter and sat in a sovereign corner of shade. Massimo continued his explanation. He said,
They are the San Fredianini. They are clannish.
You're not like that, said Ulysses.
No,
but my family is from Emilia-Romagna. Every quartiere in Firenze is different and every quartiere has its ways. Santa Croce is completely different to Santo Spirito, and Santo Spirito is completely different to Santa Maria Novella, and so on. And, he said, and stopped to drink his coffee, some resent your good fortune. How can I change that? Said Ulysses.
You can't. Time will. One day you'll wake up and it will all be different.
And he clicked his fingers, but there was no sound, because his hands were sweaty. He lit a cigarette, and Claude squawked. And you have a refrigerator, he added quickly.
Is that what this is about? Understand, at Michele's bar, there is an unofficial communal icebox. People store their milk or Sunday meat next to his gelati, and you've
walked into the square, and you have a refrigerator.
Arturo had a refrigerator. Be patient, my friend.
And Massimo finished his coffee and stood up. Shall we? They turned back onto Via dei Calzaiuoli.
Have you thought about what you want to do? Said Massimo.
Not yet, said Ulysses, stopping in front of a tailor's window display. I'd like to make globes again, he said, distracted by the loafers and fashionable styles.
Ah, mappamondi, bellissimi, said Massimo.
You like those trousers?
I do, and the shirt, and those shoes, said Ulysses.
He turned back to Massimo. I'd need to find a workshop first, for the globes, I mean. And I'd need to source the right paper.
Too easy, my friend.
And someone to print the gauze.
We'll find someone. Moon or Earth?
I've only ever made the Earth.
Palazzo Castellani, said Massimo. The Institute of the History of Science. There you will find both celestial and terrestrial globes of infinitesimale beauty.
You want to go and see about the trousers? Would you mind?
Mind? Shopping is my other great love.
After what?
Dancing.
Massimo cornered a street kid and had a robust conversation about Claude. They shook hands, and Massimo turned to Ulysses and said, I told him if he waits here with the Papagallo, I'll pay him well. If he runs away, I told him you'll chase him down and kill him. Bene, let's go in. Ulysses followed Massimo up a flight of narrow stairs that smelt of leather and aromatic smoke. Waiting for them at the top was Piccolo Nico, a small, of course, wizened tailor with a tape measure around his neck and a cigaretto in the corner of his mouth. Massimo explained what Ulysses was after, and in no time at all, the tailor had measured him for a suit, an extra pair of trousers, and a couple of shirts. And then Nico frowned and said, Un momento, before disappearing into his workshop. He came back holding a pair of cream cotton trousers described as summer light that had been made 2 months before for a young man who had died suddenly.
Exact same measurements as yours, apparently, said Massimo. You can have them at a bargain price if you're not superstitious.
If they fit well, I'm not superstitious, said Ulysses, and he took the trousers into the changing room. The trousers fitted well. He paired them with soft brown leather loafers, worn without socks, and he felt transformed.
Lucky for you, the man had good taste and bad genes, said Massimo.
Lucky for me, said Ulysses.
I'll take 'em, signore. Trousers and shoes, both.
20 minutes later, he came out of the shop, dressed like an Italian, his old clothing bundled up in brown paper under his arm, the suit and two shirts ready to be collected in September. As they crossed the Ponte Vecchio, Claude flew on ahead and Ulysses said, I was thinking, Massimo, what about a telephone? Massimo stopped and said,
What about a telephone?
What if we got one installed?
Oh, no, no. Too soon.
Too soon?
Trust me. Too soon. Not after the refrigerator.
They entered the square in time for aperitivo, and Claude flew from tree to tree and performed an impromptu aeronautical display for a group of American tourists coming back from the Brancacci Chapel. They took a table at Michele's, and Julia came out to greet them. She was always friendly and always elegant, dressed that day in a black and green house dress that accentuated her wide, rumba hips, that Massimo said had danced two girls into the world 23 years before. Her hair was held up with amber combs that had once belonged to her favourite grandmother.
How do you know all this? Said Ulysses.
But before Massimo could answer, Julia said something that made him laugh. She took their order of two Campari sodas and turned back towards the bar. When she'd gone, Massimo leant across the table and said, She thinks you look very handsome in your new clothes. Ulysses blushed and lit a cigarette. He offered his last one to Massimo.
Thank you, said Massimo, and you do look very handsome.
People from the neighbourhood began to arrive. The elderly women took their place on the stone benches and called over the young waiter for a tray of vermouth. Massimo said,
You see that woman on the left? You recognise her?
No.
That's Signora Mimi.
She recognized you straight away.
She and her husband opened the door to you during wartime. It was their kitchen you went through to get onto the roof.
I did? Massimo nodded and raised the cigarette to his lips.
Her husband died not long after, apparently. Next to her is the elderly Contessa. They were all here, you know.
And you were up there. Massimo pointed to the roof.
Michele led the chance to release the gun, and that priest over there, he prayed. Look at these people, Ulysses. the postman, the baker, her husband. They all knew you before you knew them. You may not feel it, but you have a place here. Let things settle. A little more time before the telephone. When I call you, everyone listens. Massimo laughed. That's how information is passed on. How people get to know you. It's integral to this society, I told you. Someone asked me about your mother's kidney stones. Did you tell them they've come out? That's not the point, Massimo. And I have to call England. I'd like a bit of privacy. Come to the office whenever you want. Julia placed their drinks on the table. Grazie, signora, said Ulysses. He couldn't look at her. Prego, signor Temper. Ulysses smiled. He liked the way she said temper, the way she rolled her R. What? Said Ulysses. Why are you looking at me like that? Privacy is for the confessional, said Massimo. Salute, they clinked glasses.
So, said Massimo, that brings me to the other question everyone is asking.
Church.
Church? Said Ulysses, laughing.
No way.
And he stood up and went towards the cafe. Inside, he and Michele greeted one another. Ulysses asked for a pack of camels and Michele lobbed them across the marble counter. Ulysses left a scattering of coins and turned away. He lifted his hat to wipe his forehead, the heat intense already, the overhead fan on strike again. He pushed through the stink of garlic and men, and the fresh air hit him like a punch.
I'm an idiot, Ulysses, said Massimo, reaching into his jacket pocket. I'm so sorry, a letter arrived at the office this morning, here.
Ulysses looked at the envelope, hoping it was from Peg. The writing wasn't hers, though, and the envelope carried a strong whiff of cigarettes.
Dear Temps, I'm living in the pub after I got flooded out by my upstairs neighbour. Poor bloke died. Three times, as it happened. Cole said you can't die three times, and I said he's the proof. The bloke had a heart attack in the bath, reached for the ledge, got electrocuted by the heater, shot back into the water, and drowned. If there's a God, and I'm by no means suggesting there is, I thought that was a bit heavy-handed. Bloke had only moved in for a new start. Big funeral, though. Nice touch with the trumpet player. Yesterday, Cole sent me up the ladder with a paintbrush and the pubs back to the stoat. But Gwyneth threw out the stoat while she was redecorating and didn't tell Cole. She bought a few bright cushions for the place, though she calls them soft furnishings. Cole shouts, how can we be called the stoat if we don't have a bloody stoat? How about we call it the Queen's Head, says Gwyneth. How about the Queen's Legs, says Cole. Open all hours. You disgust me, Colin Formolo, she says. Out, shouts Cole, and take the fucking cushions. And she does, you know, Temps. Loads them into her arms, one by one. Even took one out from under Mrs. Belton, and everyone knows she has that sore. And if that wasn't enough, Peg came in that night. I could see on her face something was up. Straight over to the piano, and I'm thinking, uh-oh. One word, she says. Gershwin. By God, Temps, there's no one like her. Three bars in and there's not a dry eye in the house. And then Ted's wife walks in. Peg don't stop singing. She just ups the ante. You could have heard a pin drop in Luton. And the wife, get this, the wife starts to cry. And then Ted walks in. Wife turns to Ted and here's the most extraordinary thing. The look on her face says, you win, I'm done. And out she goes. Peg finishes her song and she's all shoulders back and starlight. Peg reaches for a drink and Ted comes up to her and she says, don't you dare. Then she turns to me and says, you ready to take me home, Pete? Of course I am, I say. It was one of them rare summer nights when England ain't so bad. Her and me down by the canal singing, my heart cries for you. But mine was crying for her. That Eddie bloke, he did something to her, Temps. I know it's awkward talking to you about him, but something broke in her when he didn't come back. That bridge to happiness gone. Cress's tree retains the dignity of the old fella. There's a soothing energy comes up from the roots like it wants to chat. I sat out there one morning and wrote a new composition. Sorry's just a word. He wrote itself. At my audition for the tour of Annie Get Your Gun, they didn't like my version of there's no business like show business.
and I guess I was a bit down that day. Bitter was the word they used. So I'm back at the beginner's tap class. I found the stoat, by the way, out back by the bins. Back legs were missing. It's just a torso and a bandaged jaw. I reckon a rat got to it. I carried it into the bar and wedged it next to a bottle of Fernet Branca. Hard not to see myself sometimes in that annexed life. Life's not the same since you all left, but you're better off out of it. If I don't get the Rosemary Clooney, you know where I'll be in December. Drink a beachy cletter or two for me. Take care, Temps. Your friend, Pete. P.S. Watch your back. August's eats got fangs. Near took the skin off my shoulders when I was in Palermo.
August came, and still no word from Peg. The heat ratcheted up, as Pete said it would, and brought out the unwashed tang of people. Hot nights made sleep impossible, and a perpetual feeling of somnolence took hold. The sounds of lovemaking ceased because no one wanted to get that close. Ice cream melted before it got near mouths, and tourists cursed that they hadn't come in May. Massimo disappeared to his family home on the island of Giglio and was missed. Claude moped and developed a wheeze from the mosquito deterrents that burned day and night. Men screamed at women, and women screamed at children, and children kicked dogs for no other reason than that their blood ran hot. Then every few days clouds billowed over the hills and arms rose exultantly as violent storms rolled in. And for a brief moment, there was respite. As the month crept towards its midpoint, Ulysses grew restless. The heat was getting to him, and both Cress and the kid could see that, and every day he checked for a letter from Peg. Even sent her a postcard that said, "Remember us." Cress said he shouldn't have done it, and he knew he shouldn't have, and he regretted it straight away, but what could he do? Cress said it was probably the unreliable Italian postal system. Ulysses said he was thinking about the kid, and Cress said the kid was all right. "She'll tell us what she needs. You reckon?" "I know," said Cress. And one afternoon, outside Michele's, Ulysses happened to say, "I wonder if it's as hot back home as it is here." And Cress put down his Baedeker, noting the context and subtle use of the word home. This was the first chink in the boy's docile armour.
"Come on," said Cress, smoothing down the crumpled legs of his shorts. "Let's go for a walk."
He left a handful of lire on the table, and Ulysses called out to the kid. She was talking with a boy by the fountain.
"Of course it's my parrot," she said, and spat on the ground.
Claude flew down and landed on her arm. Kid was chatty all the way to the Pitti Palace. She said Signora Giulia wanted to know what they did at night. "What did you say?" said Ulysses.
"I said we sang songs and played cards for money."
"You told her that?" said Ulysses.
"And sometimes we talked about life, about good times and bad times, and we drank hard liquor."
"You have all the Italian words for that?"
said Cress, a little envious.
"Yep."
Kid was balancing on a ledge now.
"I said you're clean and lonely."
Cress and Ulysses stopped. "Which one?" Kid pointed to Ulysses.
"Lonely,"
she said.
"You told her that?"
"Yep."
And she ran out of ledge and jumped down.
"Why'd you tell her that?"
said Ulysses.
"Because you are," she said.
A tourist passed by and threw coins at them.
"Grazie,"
said the kid, and she bent down and picked up the lire. Through the courtyard of the Pitti Palace, at the top of the stone stairs, they met the breeze. Swallows and swifts and bells on the air. Florentines out in their droves. It's what they did in the summer months, here or Cascine Park. To be away from the streets and the dust and smells and the niggling disputes was everything in that moment. Time moved differently, as if it too had buckled with the heat, and past and present shifted into one sultry, indomitable dance. They climbed the slope up to the highest point to the Casino del Cavaliere, as storm clouds crested but didn't break. How beautiful the light! To their left, the old circuit walls carved through olive groves, and the sky was a ponderous violet grey. All around, art and life entwined. Cress held up his doorstop of a book and said,
"Baedeker,"
as if it was a new religion. And with their sight drawn across the cityscape, he said,
"That's our home down there, Tebs. Who would have believed it?"
"Not me, for one," said the kid. "Pinch me, I'm dreaming."
"See," mouthed Cress,
she's okay.
Golden light edged around the dark grey clouds, and Cress used the phrase unconscionable beauty in describing the garden. Cress was becoming poetry. On the way down, he asked for a moment by himself in the Limonaya, just him surrounded by citrons and sentiment. A nice sentence, one of Cress's specials. Said he'd meet them later, back in the square. He sat down on a wooden chair, and Claude drank from a flower pot nearby. From there, Cress's roots passed deep through the labyrinthine dark, down to ancient quarry stone and the rapography of long-gone lives. He felt the rise of those who had gone before, the poets Browning, Everly, Shelley. In time, Cress hoped to lose his fear of poetry, especially the stuff that didn't rhyme. Cress was a facts man, and facts were stone. Poetry, though, was sand, ever compared to stars in its granular infinity, ever shifting. Kid dragged Ulysses away to play hide-and-seek in the Cypress Avenue, and she stayed hidden for half an hour. A rumbling, atavistic fear possessed him, and he realized this fear now sat at the core of his life and would remain there evermore. He looked so hard and he couldn't find her. Right in front of him she was, but he couldn't see her. It was his worst nightmare, and eventually it was her giggling that woke him from it. She'd climbed into a bush like a bird and stayed so quiet. So pleased with herself she was, he overly congratulated her, just to stifle a sob. They walked hand in sweaty hand to the Isolotto and stood in front of the sculpture of Perseus on horseback, galloping up through the water.
"I'd like to do that," she said.
"Me too," he said.
And he thought they'd been so unprepared for summer and vowed it would be the last time they were.
"I'll find us a swimming pool," he said.
"Promise," she said.
"Promise," he said. And they sat in the shade and watched the ducks and shared a piece of chewing gum he found in his pocket. "I reckon your mum would like it here," he said.
"I'm not so sure she would," she said.
Hard as nails, he thought.
"Do I look like her?" she said.
"Not so much. When you smile, you do."
"Who do I look like, then?"
"Eddie, I suppose."
"Do you know him?"
"No."
"I don't either," she said.
"You sure you're okay?"
"Yep," said the kid. "This is a good day."
"I want them all to be good days," said Ulysses.
"That's unrealistic. You don't have to make up for Peg."
He laughed. "Is that what I do?"
"Relax into the job, I'd suggest."
"Anything else?"
"Maybe get a girlfriend."
"Really?"
"Someone like Signora Julia or Signora Julia herself."
"She's with Michele."
"He's got high blood pressure and angina. He could die any moment."
"How do you know all this?" Kid tapped her nose. "Anything else?"
"You're doing all right," she said.
"Thanks."
"And I don't want to be anywhere else."
"Good to know," he said. They left when the gates began to close. People outside cafes smelt soapy and evening fresh. In the square, they stopped to listen to a man play guitar on the steps of the church.
"I'm going to do that one day," said the kid.
"I know," said Ulysses. "You want to grow up quick."
"Is that a bad thing?"
"Only for me."
"There's Cressy," said the kid,
pointing to the terrace. Cress had been watching through the telescope for their return. Kid waved.
"Cress knows a lot, doesn't he, Ulysses?"
"Cress knows everything."
"Cress never went to school."
"I know. But imagine if he had." 2 days later, the Postino cycled by Michele's and flicked a postcard onto their table. It landed picture up, revealing a view of a fortress and a walled Tuscan village. Ulysses turned it over. It was from Massimo. The main news was that Massimo had got a haircut, which had taken 3 inches off his height and had plunged him into a pit of self-consciousness. It had been necessary after his nephew had infected him with lice. He said his mother's kidney stones had returned, but what can you expect? She doesn't drink water. He said he missed his new friends and told Ulysses to call him immediately and left a number at the bottom. Julia placed another round of coffee and biscotti on the table. Kid said in Italian that the postcard was from Massimo, and she showed her the picture. "Ah, Giglio," said Julia, and she asked how Massimo's mother was.
"Kidney stones have returned," said the kid, "but she doesn't drink water, so what can you expect?"
And Kid shrugged disparagingly and sipped her coffee. Ulysses picked up the card and went inside. The heat escaping the kitchen was already intense, and the overhead fan out of action again. Ulysses went to the telephone and dialed the number. Massimo picked up straight away, as if he'd been waiting all morning by the telephone, which in fact he had. He spoke quickly and precisely in case the connection cut out. He said his mother had gone back to the mainland on account of her lower body discomfort and had taken his sister and lice-infected nephew. One of his brothers had decided to go to Elba and the other brother would come in a few days. So, and this was really the crux of the matter, the house is empty. Come and visit for Ferragosto. What? Come out to Giglio. Drive down towards Grosseto, then Porto. Michele handed Ulysses a pen and a scrap of paper. Porto, said Ulysses, nodding his thanks to Michele. Porto Santo Stefano, said Massimo. Leave the car there, get the morning ferry to Isola del Giglio. Ulysses writing it all down. You need to leave tomorrow because of the Ferragosto weekend. The fair what? Said Ulysses. Public holidays. If you don't, you'll be stranded. The line cut. The sound of the tokens being swallowed. Ulysses replaced the receiver and turned back to the room. The bar had fallen silent. Everyone was looking at him, and not all of them were pleased. Someone said, You going to Giglio now? They left early the following morning, as instructed. The sun had barely lit the eastern sky when they stepped out of the building. They walked across the square, clutching rucksacks and bottles of water, and Claude flew on ahead to Betsy. They travelled south through Tuscany as the sun rose, and eventually a landscape of hilltop towns gave way to thick forests of chestnut trees and fields of sunflowers, and it was quite a sight to behold. Cress leant out of the window, and Kid said, First one to see the sea. But the sea had spied her long before. Stripped down to her new swimming costume she was, face pressed close to the glass, not missing a thing. From Orbitello, they crossed the lagoon and drove up into the wild Monte Argentario, a rocky promontory surrounded by the Tyrrhenian Sea. Roads were overgrown with forests and the smell was salty and herbaceous, and at the base of the great cliffs, glimpses of coves and beaches could be had. The dark green canopy thinned out as the road veered down towards the port, the aftermath of wartime bombardment still evident. Ulysses parked away from the main road and they grabbed their bags and ran towards the ferry up ahead. They were the last aboard and the klaxon blared and the slow chug of the engine pushed clouds of dark smoke into a pristine sky. The water was as crystalline and turquoise as they had ever seen, and Claude flew free. A soft headwind brought the sun's rays to their noses and foreheads, and Kid put on her sunglasses. Kid had never been to an island before, and she stood up suddenly and punched her arms in joy. When Giglio came into sight, it reflected the long, hot parchment of summer. Rocky granite crags were tufted by Macchia Mediterranea and little else. As they drew near to the harbour, the klaxon sounded, and a crescent of bright sand came into sight, and fisher cottages and donkeys waiting to transport luggage up the steep island slopes. It was like stepping back in time, the whole scene overlaid with a sepia tint. And as the ferry moored alongside the harbour wall, they looked about for Massimo. Claude was the first to spot him, though, standing in a small boat and waving furiously.
You made it, he shouted. Mio Dio, you made it.
You look so well. What about this heat? I like your hair. You still got lice. No, no, all gone. I've got a new swimming costume. Cress is spying on the stone bench, signore.
Ready?
Said Massimo, catching his breath. Ready, they said, catching theirs. And Massimo pulled the cord, and whatever peace had settled across the harbour and whatever conversation was still to be had was swallowed by the ugly whine of a two-stroke. The boat hugged the curve of the island, which revealed a little more to its excited visitors. Hillside vineyards and pear-laden cacti and granite steps from which to swim. Kid leant over the side to catch every wave that slapped against the hull. Eventually, the engine steadied and the boat veered right towards a vast expanse of shingled beach. They glimpsed a house near the back, protected by native pines and eucalypts. Massimo tilted the engine, and the shallow hull glided effortlessly to shore. Cressy was the first onto the island. All he needed was a flag to plant. He looked about at the bounty of existence, full consciousness in the soles of his feet.
"This way!" shouted Massimo.
Across the shingle, the metronomic fall of waves overlapped with the call of doves. Massimo marching ahead, waving his arms in a manner most peculiar. He was nervous and shy, and had never had anyone visit before. Never invited anyone, truth be told. And he felt grateful when the shingle ran out, and the house reared up in its charming incongruity, part cottage, part shack.
"This is it," he said. "Go find a bedroom while I prepare lunch." And he held up a canvas bag brimming with supplies.
There was nothing now between them and 3 days of holiday.
Kid took off across the beach, the shingle hot on her bare feet, Ulysses not far behind. She'd never swum in the sea before, certainly nowhere where the fish were as striped as her. "Waist height in the water now, not even one bit cold," was her shout.
Kid held her nose and ducked under and came up spluttering.
"Again," she said.
"I'll be here," he said. Under she went. Under he went. They broke the surface together with a leap. Massimo calling out that lunch was ready.
"I don't need lunch," said Kid.
"Yeah, you do," said Ulysses. "Come on." And they waded through the shallows, back to the towels.
"Everyone look at the camera," shouted Massimo as he set the timer and ran back into position.
Click. Caught forever. From left, old Cress stands next to Massimo with Ulysses on the right. Their arms are around one another. Kid is standing in front of Massimo holding Claude. Claude has opted for the full wingspan look. Behind them is a glimpse of the terrace, pots of geraniums, a trestle table with the remains of spaghetti al pomodoro and potatoes and baccala, and 2 bottles of the crisp white Ansonica wine native to the island. One of the bottles is a good 2/3 full. Above them, a grapevine casts abundant shade and clusters of grapes hang low. The kid is wearing her swimming costume and sunglasses. They are the best things she has ever owned. The costume is still damp from a swim and will chafe her bum by evening. It will be uncomfortable, but worth it. Cress wears a light blue shirt and desert shorts. His feet are bare and he's conscious of the length of his toenails. Apart from that blip, he feels whole and courageous. He knows he's making up for lost time. Massimo sports an outfit of matching navy, Bermuda shorts in a cotton linen mix in a similar shade of blue to his ironed, short-sleeved shirt. Before his friends arrived, he felt shy about his hair and the weight that had accumulated around his middle. But Ulysses told him he looked so distinguished. "You're a good-looking fella, Mass," were the words he used, "and sometimes that's all you need to restore a little height." Massimo will not grow his hair long again. Ulysses wears white shorts that stop just above his knee. His knees are good, and the fall of the hem only accentuates that fact. He wears a white vest, not dissimilar to the way Marlon Brando wore his in A Streetcar Named Desire. Ulysses hasn't seen the film. The vest is a tight fit due to shrinkage. His smile is as disarming as ever. His eyebrows sit at an upward slant on account of the sun, and the tips of his ears are reddening. It would be the first of many photographs taken over the years on Giglio. It would hang on the wall in the living room between 2 windows where white curtains billow on a salt-drenched breeze. Through the windows, the eucalypts throw off a keen scent. They have been on the island approximately 26 hours and 37 minutes. Not long, but Cress would have broken that down and calculated 1,000 moments, because Cress was like that. Nearing their last day, a little twist of Cress occurred, and not before time. Massimo had just made a pot of coffee and was asking Ulysses if he had any idea yet what he wanted to do with the downstairs flat, when Cress staggered out onto the terrace and said,
"I know what we're going to do with the downstairs flat."
"Extraordinary," said Massimo. "Does this happen a lot?"
"Quite a lot," said the kid.
Cress took a sip of water and stumbled to a chair.
"I had a vision," he said,
and proceeded to describe exactly what had happened to him only moments before.
"I'd just finished my coffee. It was delicious, by the way, Massimo, he said, interrupting his own story. And I'd settled down on that lovely armchair to make a start on the novel I brought from England, fiction being uncharted territory for me, as you all know.
Cress took another sip of water. He said,
I opened the novel and began to read, and it was as if a large celestial index finger reached across the sky and pointed directly at me, Alfred Cresswell. Like Michelangelo's creation of Adam, where God points and gives life to, in this case, that idea.
And, said Ulysses, Cress held up his copy of A Room with a View.
The precedent has been set, Tebs,
he flicked through the pages,
and I quote, and a cockney besides.
Pause. Besides what? Said Ulysses.
A cockney landlady at the Bertolini.
What's the Bertolini?
A pensione, said Cress. A boarding house. Mostly for English people, awful ones, mind, and if I'm honest, the food ain't much cop, but still.
Ulysses reached for the book and scanned the pages.
A cockney landlady ran a boarding house in Florence 50-odd years back, and that's all we need to know. We could be that story too, said Cress. Put the rooms to use. Get a bit of purpose.
And money, said Kid.
A pensione, said Massimo. What a wonderful idea.
I'm in,
said the Kid.
Tebs, what do you think?
What's to think, he said. Let's do it. Massimo said he'd contact a colleague after Ferragosto to talk about licensing and registration, and Cress channeled the god of hospitality. He couldn't write ideas down quick enough. Locks on the doors, more linen, towels, soap, laundry service.
Maybe get a washing machine. Too soon for a washing machine, Massimo.
Massimo said he'd head back and listen out for word on the street.
Back to the bathhouse with you, said the Kid.
And Massimo blushed and reached for his hair, which, of course, wasn't there. They went out that afternoon to forage for figs and apricots and caper berries, and Ulysses happened to say in passing that he always found a communal bowl of fruit welcoming.
Nice touch, said Massimo.
Cress wrote down bowl of fruit.
And flowers, said Massimo.
Flowers, wrote Cress.
What about a help yourself to drinks trolley?
Help yourself,
scoffed Claude, who was starting to sound a bit like Cole.
Easy, Claude, said Ulysses. We're not like that here.
And Claude apologised and felt ashamed.
And what about advertising, said Massimo.
Cress whistled at the enormity of the word.
Can't we just wait at the railway station with a sign and meet the trains as they come in, drive them back in the jowet?
That's what I could do, said the Kid. Who's going to say no to a cute kid and a parrot?
No one, said Massimo. No one at all. And you intend to feed them, your guests?
Cress looked daunted.
Feed them what?
In the kitchen, in a haze of steam, Massimo said, if I teach you nothing else in your lifetime, it must be this. Learning the correct ratio of boiling water to salt to pasta. When to add the salt, lots of it. When to take the pasta off the heat. Get it right, and you'll always eat like a king.
Get it wrong, said the Kid, and we'll end up with that mess called Papa al Pomodoro. Right, Cress?
Massimo said, a simple addition of garlic and olive oil and chili. Here, try this. You feel the resistance of the spaghetti? That is what you aim for every time.
Cress and Ulysses stood back and made notes. Kid just ate.
You two up for this? She said.
Maybe we could just give guests vouchers to use at Michaelis, said Cress.
Now you're thinking,
said Claude.